Greetings, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum, and chair of the program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker for this evening's program. Dr. Russ Jaffe received his AB, MD, and PhD in biochemistry and physiology from Boston University, all in May 1972. Dr. Jaffe's training included internal medicine followed by residency in clinical pathology. He is board certified in clinical pathology with a subspecialty certification in chemical pathology. Dr. Jaffe remained on the permanent senior staff of the NIH Clinical Pathology Department, where he continued method innovation and was active in collaborative research with the Laboratory of Experimental Atherosclerosis of the Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. Concurrently, Dr. Jaffe's interest in the mechanisms of health and the evoking of human healing responses led him to apprentice in such healing arts as acupuncture, mindfulness, massage, music, art, and color therapy, and a variety of eclectic therapeutic approaches. In addition, Dr. Jaffe performed innovative studies of platelet function and blood clotting in relation to the origins of coronary artery and cardiovascular disease. Among the tests he developed are the early colon cancer screening test using occult blood detection not interfered with by vitamin C consumption, as well as a variety of tests related to blood clotting, immune function, and repair systems. He also developed the first method of measuring cell-mediated immunity using a modified ELISA system in a lymphocyte mitogenesis blastogenesis brief cell culture known as lymphocyte response assays, or LRA. Dr. Jaffe has contributed over 100 symposium-invited talks, scientific articles or book chapters. He received the J.D. Lane Award for Original Research from the United States Public Health Service and the Merck Sharp and Dome Excellence in Research Award, and in 2003 he was recognized as International Research Scientist of the Year, among other recognitions for his work. I think without further ado, I will introduce Dr. Jaffe.
Thank you, Bill.
And thank you, Bill. Thank you all. Thank you all for being here. Nice to see some familiar faces and some new faces. I will be talking for a few minutes, but the bulk of the evening will be more dialogue than monologue. As Bill indicated, I was a student at Boston University longer in tenure than most of the janitors. Only had one graduation, but it was a good day. And through great good fortune, I did end up with a medical training in internal medicine with some background in biochemistry and interest in kind of how the molecular side of life worked. Had the good fortune to have some early publications that got me to the National Institutes of Health, did residency in clinical pathology, thought I'd stay there forever, had a wonderful time, but as Bill indicated, my interest shifted from the mechanisms of disease, a very important subject, to the mechanisms of health. And it's another story for another time, but for various reasons, and certainly then you could not, by law, study health at the National Institutes of Health. Now, that may seem a little paradoxic to you, but it would take most of the evening to explain why it's not called the NID, and it's called the NIH. But it deserves to be the NIH. It doesn't deserve to be the NID. But for various reasons, what I wanted to do, which was understand why healthy people lose vitality and what you can do to restore it, it was, in the common parlance, out of step with the wagon train. Because I was trained as a pathologist. What do pathologists want to know about health? Well, seemed to me that the shoulders I was standing on, and I'll talk about them in a minute, required me to follow my nose and end up here with you this evening. Along the way, I had the privilege of helping found the Certified Clinical Nutrition Program so that there are functional and integrative and holistic nutritionists available for clinical work. I am a fellow of the National Academy for Clinical Biochemistry, which in my field is some honor. And you can see all those initials down below the name, which indicates either that I'm easily bored or that I'm a fellow of many different societies, ranging from clinical pathology to clinical nutrition to allergy, asthma, and immunology, Medical Laboratory Immunology, Clinical Immunology Society, and I'm an overseas fellow of the Royal Society of Medicine. Our research is done through the Health Studies Collegium. I'm a fellow of that, and I founded and direct both ELISA Act Biotechnologies, that's the blood testing lab that does this immunology test, as well as PERC, which provides professional quality supplements and rethinks the whole category of dietary supplements in safer, more effective ways. Now, I started as a skeptic. I started to debunk what I will advocate for tonight. And I understand it's okay if I advocate, but I won't sell nothing, not myself. I started as a skeptic to debunk such areas as mindfulness and acupuncture and lifestyle and subtle energies and all of that, and have come to feel that if your perspective is physiology, if you start with physiology first as your principle, you will accept anything that works empirically as long as the evidence supports it, and you'll figure out the mechanisms later. It doesn't have to fit a predetermined, what I will call, reductionist paradigm or any particular way of thinking. So, physiology first is the principle, but the practice is what we call the alkaline way. Now, the alkaline way is a mechanism for assessing your own quality of living, and I'll tell you how to do that. And it is also a plan for restoring or enhancing or protecting your health, whichever is appropriate. So, it's a personal journey. It's a journey from submolecular reductionism. There was a time when I knew so much about such a specialized area that nobody knew as much as I did about that little deep aspect of science. And in that environment, if you can keep publishing, probably you will be accepted because no one else knows what you know about what it is. See, this fellow's shaking his head. He knows, right? Are you a scientist or do you have an interest in science? Engineer? Okay, same as engineering. We just hold things differently. Engineers go this way, we go that way. So from submolecular reductionism to physiology first principles and alkaline way practices, and I am going to talk first about what I learned about occult blood testing for colon cancer detection. And this, if you see this slide, or if you care to read it, it says that there are a group of us who published in 1975 about DK. Her name was Doris. And she had unexplained anemia. And while she didn't tell the doctors that she took vitamin C, she did. And because she had anemia that looked like blood loss, the doctors sent stool to analyze, and it was negative, so they sent another one. And they sent 472 of them. 472 negative occult blood tests, but they still kept sending them because the doctor knew that her clinical picture fit blood loss and they had no other explanation. And he didn't care, or she didn't care. Let me think about this. He didn't care. And so they just kept sending stool specimens. And we, the laboratory, kept sending them back negative. And on the 472nd specimen, I was the resident on call. And I thought anyone that had sent 472 poops to our laboratory deserved a visit. And I walked in, and this woman, Doris, said, "What are you doing here?" She had a very firm voice. I said, "I'm a doctor." She says, "You are?" I said, "Yes, ma'am, I am." She says, "What kind of a doctor?" I said, "Well, I'm up from the laboratory, and I'm a pathologist." She says, "I'm not that sick." I said, "Ma'am, no, no. I'm not an anatomic pathologist. I'm a clinical pathologist." "What's that?" "Ma'am, can I just talk to you?" "Sure, why not?" "Ma'am, what have you not told the other doctors?" She says, "Shh," and she opens a drawer like she's going to show me something contraband, and it's vitamins. And she whispers, "You're a nice young man. I take this vitamin C, but I don't tell the doctors." "Well, why don't you tell the doctors, Doris?" "Well, because they'll take it away from me." I said, "Why?" "Because they did before." "Why did they do that?" "Well, they thought it might interfere with some therapy." "Well, then why do you take it?" "Because I feel better." "Oh. And what happens when you stop taking it?" "I feel worse. Didn't you hear me?" "Yes, I did, ma'am." Okay, so we went off to the laboratory. And we found that indeed, good old-fashioned vitamin C, above about a gram a day, above about 1,000 milligrams a day, progressively inhibits, makes falsely negative, the test. So every one of those stools probably had extra blood in it that we couldn't find because the test was falsely negative for reasons we didn't know. So my takeaway, what I would like you to learn from my experience, is that sometimes the tests are wrong. I can tell you, and I hope this isn't a surprise, but no test is perfect. No test is absolute. Tests are done on people. They're not done on statistics. And frankly, I've never taken care of a statistic as a doctor. So more precise tests we developed. One of the outcomes was that before the test that we did, the one that we introduced, it cost about $250,000 to detect an early colon cancer. And if it was your colon cancer, you might want to have society spend that money. But it's actually a lot of money to spend to screen for a few extra colon cancers. And with a more precise, a more sensitive, a more specific, a more predictive test, the cost went down to $14,000. So hopefully we saved some people some money and helpfully also avoided a whole lot of unnecessary barium enemas and colonoscopies in people who had eaten green beans. Because it turns out that green beans cause a false positive test. Who knew? Who knew? On the bottom of many of the slides, there'll be references for those of you who want to follow through on that kind of evidence base, but I hope some of this will be novel enough that you want to follow through on it, and I do want you to know where it comes from. Now, the second step in our journey is a different aspect of science. This has to do with collagen crosslinks and D-penicillamine. Now, collagen, if you see on the lower left what looks like a series of ropes coiled together, that's a collagen fibril. It's unique in biology because they're very narrow and very long, and you actually have collagen fibrils that go from your toe to your brain. And one of my hypotheses is that they're not just piezoelectric, they actually carry acupuncture information, but that's a different lecture for a different time. So I started out in biology and biochemistry learning about the cross-links and how these unique structural molecules hold together. Collagen and elastin. Elastin like rubber bands in the upper right. And collagen, the fibrils, the ropes that hold the body together. And that in the dark ages when I studied were considered to be ground substance. Can't be very interesting if it's the ground substance or the connecting tissue, the connective tissue. Well, it turns out it's actually very active. But we didn't know how to ask, and it didn't tell us. So I worked in an area because there was a scientist who I wanted to have as my advisor, not because it was a hot area of science. And what we did was we worked out how a molecule called D-penicillamine inhibits the cross-linking, inhibits the zippering of these molecules together, and showed the mechanism on the top is work that was done at the National Institutes of Dental Research by George Martin and Sheldon Pinnell and others. And on the bottom is the work that I got the Merck Sharp and Dohme Award for, showing that the four hypotheses that had been considered before did not explain the data, and that something, a different mechanism that had not been proposed, did fit the data, and as far as I know, still does. And so we had the good fortune of working this out, and that earned me a doctorate. And I thought, well, that's nice, and I'm now going to go be a doctor. 20 years later, and we'll get into this in the course of the next few minutes, but 20 years later, I helped develop the D-penicillamine provocation test for mineral status. You can tell through another mechanism having nothing to do with the collagen and elastin, but you can use penicillamine to mobilize minerals out of cells and get the nutritional, the essential, the beneficial minerals quantified, as well as the toxic minerals. And it was my knowledge of how to use penicillamine so that you could allow the cross-linking to happen. You wouldn't give the penicillamine every day. You'd allow the cross-linking to happen, but you would get the benefits of mobilizing the toxic minerals and getting them out of the body, but also, if you use it diagnostically, get information about the status of essential minerals in the body. So sometimes what you do early on has an unforeseen consequence later on. That's the takeaway. My first publication was actually in the NATO Proceedings. This was about this work on the chemistry and biosynthesis of crosslinks in elastin. And Ed Balazs, the editor, was a fairly prominent guy in science and actually was the fellow I got the slide on the left from. There are two different colors. I hope you can see that they're two different colors. One of those colors stains the collagen. The other stains the elastin. And on the right, although it's a little hard to see on the slide, is the actual coming together of different lysine molecules. Lysines are amino acids. They're components of proteins. Lysines are the sources for these cross-links. 2 to 4 lysines come together and form the cross-links, and then you make these very interesting, what are called desmosine or structural amine adducts, complexes. In the lower right is an actual capsule of penicillamine. Cupramine is the trade name. It's been used for many years in people safely to mobilize extra copper, but it actually picks up anything with 2 charges, any divalent cation, any mineral, and that's how we use it in this context. Now, the third stop along the way. This has to do with the work that I started at the National Institutes of Health, and it had to do with how platelets are activated by collagen. And it actually went back to work that started when I was a student. As a student, I wanted to join the Harvard teaching system, and so I went to Beth Israel Hospital, and I did an elective in blood clotting for Dan Dakin. And I rotated through the lab, and we got to this day when they were teaching me about how platelets clump together, how they aggregate or clump together. And they said, well, we can use adrenaline. I said, I know what that is. And we can use ADP, which is kind of like ATP, but a little bit lower on the chain. And I understood what that was. And then they said, and we stimulate platelets with collagen. Now, I didn't tell them I had a PhD in collagen, but I asked them, what's collagen? And they said, well, you see, we take the tail of a rat and we strip off these fibers and we weigh out a certain amount of ice and we put it in the blender for 30 seconds and we filter it through cheesecloth and that's collagen. Oh. Let me understand this. You make a daiquiri out of a rat's tail and that's collagen? Well, that's what Born and Cross did. Well, who's Born and Cross? The guys who first put a rat's tail with a certain amount of wet ice in a blender and put it through cheesecloth. Oh, those guys. So I went back to our laboratory where we had hundreds and hundreds of different kinds of collagens in highly purified forms. And we found to our surprise, and this really was to our surprise, we found to our surprise that collagen must be linked together in a very unique way in order to activate the platelet. It's not predictable from the primary, secondary, or tertiary structure. In fact, the article, and Dan Dakin, my co-author, wrote the title, and it's a very important title. It was the first time that anyone had produced evidence for a structural or quaternary requirement for anything in biology. We went way out on the limb in the Journal of Clinical Investigation. If we were wrong, it would have been a bad day. We hypothesized that things in biology occur that you can't predict from the primary, secondary, and tertiary structure. They only emerge. They're emergent properties that only come forward when things aggregate or stack together. So we showed that individual collagen molecules prevent platelets from aggregating. We quantified the number of binding sites on a platelet. If you ever want to know how many binding sites there are on your platelets, I can, one of the few people who can tell you that. And for a young investigator, to have, I think it was the third publication I have, appear in the Journal of Clinical Investigation, was really very thrilling. So we worked out how collagen aggregates platelets, this quaternary unexpected action. There have now been several hundred different examples. We just happened to be the first to suggest quaternary effects. How to block platelet aggregation with monomeric collagen. We quantified the number of binding sites. We developed dose-response platelet aggregation, also known as platelet aggravation by the people who do the studies. I was privileged to collaborate with Don Fry and Bob Maley from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute on animal models of heart disease. And what we found was that distress was very important. If a foxhound is stressed, it gets a lot more heart disease than if it's not stressed. And if you have a foxhound, Tom Wolfley spent 2 of his professional years working out a socialization rating scale for foxhound dogs, and then another year on Yucatan pigs. So I can actually tell you if your foxhound dog is depressed or not. It turns out that oxidized cholesterol and oxidized essential fats are highly damaging to blood vessels, but cholesterol and triglycerides are innocent bystanders. That immune reactions turn out to be very important. They can damage the lining cells and start the hardening process in the arteries. The so-called vulnerable plaque of Furster is something that we hypothesized in the 70s and that he published about a few years ago. But cholesterol and triglyceride and the things that doctors conventionally measure today, even today, notice decades later, even today, are innocent bystanders, not predictive, not sensitive, not specific, and I don't do them as a doctor. No, because I do sensitive, specific, and predictive tests. Now we're up to the fourth step, actually the fourth through the seventh stop, mindfulness, traditional Chinese medicine, Ayurveda, and homeopathy, under an umbrella called removing obstacles to health or removing obstacles to cure. I had the privilege of having almost 20 years with a Cambodian gentleman named Bhante Dharmawara, among other things, learning from him about mindfulness or what's called Vipassana. He decoded a color healing system, a non-invasive system using healing that the Buddha disclosed 2,500 years ago, but had been lost for somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 years. It wasn't clear how long it had been lost, but a long time. He decoded it, and I learned about him through that work, and then had the privilege, as I said, of learning from him over those years. I spent 7 years in a traditional apprenticeship with Qing Wu. I went to him to debunk him and saw things in his acupuncture clinic that were remarkable, that I could not explain, and that he would not explain. In fact, the first year that I was his student, I don't think he looked at me, and I'm sure that he didn't talk to me, because it got to be an issue with me that he wouldn't even talk to me. I'm a doctor from the National Institutes of Health, remember? And he didn't care, because if you're not serious enough to be there for the work itself without any other invitation, he wasn't going to encourage you. Now, by the second year, he got interesting, and I can tell you, by the fifth year, he was absolutely fascinating. Had the privilege of helping translate the Nanqing with him. That's the middle of the three books, classic texts of Chinese medicine, never been rendered into a Western language before. I had 12 years with Ramamurti Mishra, who founded the Yoga Society here in San Francisco and a number of other places. He was cross-trained, as I was, MD, PhD. He studied in Varanasi or Benares, a holy city in India. Wrote the textbook of yoga psychology, wrote Self-Awareness, Self-Knowledge, wrote about Patanjali's sutras and commentaries on them. I've also had over 20 years with Abdulaziz Saeed, so I'm not as young as I look. He is a mindfulness practitioner. He's a Sufi. He's an Islamic gentleman from Syria. This will be his 54th year teaching at American University. And on the side, he leads the Sufi Order of the East. While my children were young, John Young and Tom Brown came to our home to teach wilderness awareness. And I thought being with the kids was a really good idea, so I went out in the woods with them and had the privilege of being part of what is a renaissance now of regenerative design, nature and wilderness awareness in the United States, especially out of Commonweal here in Bolinas, where my now 21-year-old son, Sky, studied after living at the Yoga Society a year or so ago. And I'm very grateful to Michael Lerner and to the folks at Commonweal for all they have done to bring these ideas forward in a careful, methodical, scientific, evidence-based way. And personally very privileged because the fellow I mentioned, Bhante, was also the mentor to the gardeners that started the Commonweal Biodynamic Permaculture Garden. And so the first Vipassana courses in California that Bhante did were actually at Commonweal in Bolinas in the late 1970s. So it all kind of comes around in a very small world way. So if we look at physiology first, if we look at the alkaline way, if we want to use physiology and pharmacognosy before pharmacology. Now, I know that's a lot of syllables, but is that clear to everybody? Because if it's not, I'll be happy to translate it. Not so clear. Use nature and nature's pharmacy, that's pharmacognosy, use natural products before prescriptive medications. Notice I said before, not in place of. Get the good stuff in and the bad stuff out, and then see what's left. Use the natural products in standardized ways first, and then see what medications and prescriptions you need probably you'll have less polypharmacy, probably you'll have less adverse events, probably you'll have more benefit. To make that clear, if you had a cancer, you have about a 25% chance of getting cisplatinum as a chemotherapy. But cisplatinum lowers the magnesium in the very cells of the body and can actually cause so many adverse events because of low magnesium that the doctors often have to discontinue the cisplatinum until the magnesium comes back up, and then they can continue the therapy. There are ways of getting magnesium into the body. Some of them we have discovered, but there are ways of getting magnesium into the body. And if you give magnesium, that's the pharmacognosy, at the same time you're giving the cisplatinum, that's the pharmacology, you get better outcomes, lower adverse events, the side effect goes away because the magnesium depletion doesn't occur when you replete it at the same time it's being depleted. Is that clear? Okay. So we want to remove the obstacles to recovery and use the best benefit-to-risk ratio for what remains. That's the highfalutin way of saying it. We've done studies to test this hypothesis in diabetes, where the significance was below the 0.01 level, in fibromyalgia, where it was below the 0.05 level, in adrenal stress, where it was below the 0.001 level. We have 50,000 cases in a database. And it is my view, in synthesis, that autoimmune diseases, the very common autoimmune diseases, the diabetes and rheumatoid arthritis and multiple sclerosis, the asthma, the myasthenia gravis, the eczema, psoriasis, there are actually many hundreds of diseases that we think of today medically as caused by immune dysfunction. They're autoimmune conditions. And that's the area that we work in. So diabetes is the classic autoimmune condition, fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome, the mystery conditions, the immune dysfunction, and then the adrenal stress, which relates to how robust your immune system is in helping you defend yourself. Now, the area that we work in is the control system. This is a slide that friends from the Smithsonian loaned me. On the left, as you look at that slide, you see the hormone, the glands of the body. If you look more carefully, you would see the adrenal glands and the thyroid and the pituitary and the testes or ovaries. In the center, you see the nervous system. On the right side, you see the lymphatic and immune system. And I'll stop here for just a moment because in Chinese medicine, there is no hormonal system, there is no neurochemical nervous system, there is no immune system. How come these great observers missed all of that? But they have something we don't have. They have a governing vessel. They have 12 major systems, 10 of which correspond in the West to organ systems, and two, the conception vessel and the governing vessel, don't correspond to our usual structure. They realized that the hormonal, neurochemical, and immune system were three aspects of one governing control system. The governing vessel is the integration of the neuroimmunohormonal system. That, to me, was a great insight, which I'm happy to share with you, but it helps bridge the philosophy and practice of traditional Chinese medicine and the Western science when you appreciate that integration. So healthy neuroimmunohormonal function means ample capacity to neutralize foreign antigens. You can think here of a bacteria, a virus, anything you might be anxious or concerned about. And it keeps the body tolerant because these first responder cells are able to neutralize anything that's foreign that comes in. So there's no delayed allergy, there's tolerance, there's better digestion, and good hydration. Turns out that you do have to have enough water, enough hydration to keep the system fluid and going. Now, this is either a bird that has been smoking, or it's been a misty morning, or it's a cold, chilly day. I'll let you decide. But anything up until now that you want me to clarify, anything that I said that didn't make sense or that that I can in some way reinforce? Because if it's okay, I'll go on, and then we'll get to questions. If any of you do have questions, please write them down. This is the technical slide, so really do pay attention to this one. This is a takeaway. We are what we eat and drink, think, and do. What we eat and drink, think, and do determines who we are. So if you want to know what you will be tomorrow, tell me what you're thinking, eating, drinking, and doing today, and I can predict it. That's what it comes down to. It took me decades to get to that. This is actually a high point of the talk. I hope you'll take notes. Foods we can beneficially digest, that we can take up, utilize, and excrete without food allergies, without sensitivities, without intolerances. They should be nutrient-dense. They should be uncontaminated. They should be vine-ripened. They should be in a kind of Mediterranean, or what I call a Meso-Sino-Indo-Thai Mediterranean healthy diet. And what I mean there is, there are principles of the alkaline way, and you can eat any cuisine you choose within a healthier alkaline way approach. I did at one time go around the planet looking at the healthiest diet and the people who lived the longest and felt the best, and they all ate an alkaline way diet. It was just different in Thailand than it was in Central America. But it was always alkaline forming as the central component of the healthiest diet in every society. The Joy of Eating the Alkaline Way is now in its 18th edition. This is something we put out to clarify and reinforce some of this for people who want more information. So we want the foods we can digest to reverse or prevent food allergies, but sometimes we have maldigestion. Sometimes the foods we eat begin to eat us, and we actually need to have tests, including the lymphocyte response assay by Eliza Ack that I developed, to tell us which foods and chemicals are burdening the immune system, are promoting ill health, and preventing good health from being restored. The first principle here in regard to eating is that we have sufficient nutrients to fuel ourselves. We want antioxidants to prevent oxidative stress. Most people know that stress will get you. It's actually the oxidative part of the stress that gets you. And if you have enough antioxidants to prevent the oxidative stress from damaging you, you can prevent the damage, not the distress. You might still cry, but you won't have an adverse consequence at the molecular level. So antioxidants prevent oxidative stress. Inflammation is really rethought by us as repair deficit. And when you understand it as repair deficit, you can do something about it. If it's inflammation, you probably want to fight it. So we recommend ascorbate calibration, finding out how much vitamin C you need as an individual. We recommend checking for metabolic acidosis. First morning urine pH will tell you that. We recommend doing the D-penicillamine provocation to find out the nutritional, essential, and toxic mineral status. And we recommend checking for food effects on body chemistry so you can eat a diet that promotes your health rather than a diet that erodes your health. The way Mel Brooks, the 2,000-year-old man, says it, most Americans dig their graves with their fork. So we recommend a personalized diet. We recommend a restoration of tolerance and self-regulation. We recommend that we reset immune responses, that the body does forgive and remember. Your body doesn't forget, but it can forgive. It doesn't stay allergic all the time if you give it what it needs to restore healthy homeostasis or self-restoration. The classic maxim in medicine remains once reactive, always reactive. Once allergic, always allergic. You got the patient for life. You can put it down as an annuity. That's not our point of view. Our point of view is you can reset the immune system to tolerance, and we recommend that. Ecological Intelligence is a book by Dan Goleman. Anything that Dan Goleman has written, I recommend, but particularly Ecological Intelligence, not just because of his very fine acknowledgement of my work in there, but because of the quality of the book itself. This is a slightly enlarged version where you see the brain talking to the body and the body talking to the brain, and there's a lot of details in there, but that's what this is about. It shows the intimate interconnections. Ben Franklin said, "Of starvation, I saw a few die, of overeating, 100,000. And since I told you about Mel Brooks, I'll mention that in the early 19th century, a fellow was found in the United Kingdom who was confirmedly 136 years of age. And they were so impressed with this that they brought him to court. And he ate at the king's table and died in 6 months. He did. And when he died, there was fat all over his body. And when he entered, he was lean. So you have to be careful when you're eating at the king's table. The way I paraphrase that is, eat like a peasant, feel like a king or queen. So drink hard water with more than a gram of minerals per liter. Avoid soft plastic bottles. Test your water or play roulette. I don't think there's an answer to paper or plastic. I don't think there's an answer to bottled water versus tap water. I think it has to do with your tap, your water, your bottle. I prefer safer choices. That means glass or hard plastic. I do not accept soft plastic as safe. I know too much about soft plastic. And I think when you do know the facts, it makes sense to follow through on what you know. So I think there's some tap water in the country that's really safe, and you don't need to pay for bottled water. But most of the processed water that comes out of the tap is gray water, not to be confused with potable water. Potable water is drinkable water. Gray water is what you wash your clothes with. Most of what comes out of the tap in America is gray water. And my friend George Leone, among other things, started Alcon Laboratories in Fort Worth, Texas, and was for many years on the Tarrant County, Fort Worth, Texas, water board. I said, George, what was it like? He said, every year the water got more contaminated, so what did you do, George? We lowered the standards. Because we didn't have the money, we couldn't build the infrastructure anew to do it right, we didn't want to worry people, so we just kept voting to lower the standards. Okay. Hydration. You can now test, right now, at this moment, your hydration status. You need a hand. You need a palm. You need skin on the back of your palm. You need to take the other hand and put it on the back of your palm and squeeze the skin gently. This is not an exercise in masochism. Just squeeze gently and let it go. Let it go. If it goes flat immediately, if it goes flat before you can say 1/1000, if it goes flat immediately, then you're well hydrated. And if it doesn't, there's water right outside this room. You can drink water while listening to this talk. I have water right here. I will show you. But I can drink water while the talk goes on. This is the best free test I know for dehydration. And I can tell you that even 3% dehydrated, which you can see on the skin going slowly to flat, even 3% dehydrated is a significant medical risk. It also makes you irritable. It makes you lose restorative sleep. It makes any other therapies less effective. So Batmanjelic, I don't remember how to spell that name, but Batmanjelic, a remarkable doctor who, when he was being tortured in a prison, wrote a book about water therapy because he didn't want what he had learned to be lost. And somehow one of his captors found this manuscript and read it, and it was, you know, clearly a work of service to humanity. So they'd stopped beating him up. He told the story many times. He lived in Virginia later in his life, near where we live, in Vienna, Virginia. And he said, he wrote a book actually called You're Not Sick, You're Thirsty. It's an interesting idea. In the old days, the first thing doctors recommended to patients was drink a glass of water. And the second thing was take 2 drops of iodine. And the third recommendation was take magnesium. In fact, another colleague wrote a book called First of All, Do No Harm. Second of All, Think of Magnesium. So there are tests that are functional, but they're unconventional. I think today's unconventional will become tomorrow's conventional, but they're very different approaches in philosophy and practice. We can use the body's control system, the neuroimmunohormone governing vessel. We can look at therapeutic biofeedback the way Pat Norris has pioneered it. We can look at mindfulness the way Bhante Dharmawara or Bob Lykman have brought it forward. Howard Zinn's work and Dan Goleman's is equally commendable. These are all companionable with any other approach that one would like to have. I recommend moving youthfully. Stretching, I think, is really helpful, like Bonnie Pruden or a la Milton Traeger. I think continuous breathing is a recommended art. Even while listening, you know, many people, when they pay attention, they stop breathing. I recommend breathing. Even while giving a talk, I recommend breathing. So breath as a refuge, and light as a mood modulator, the way Patanjali recommended it and Ramamurthy Mishra explained it. I recommend keeping core strength through the entire life cycle. I recommend rotation. If you just move forward and backward, you will miss rotational movement, which is important, and that it actually can be a joy to move within your capabilities. I don't recommend that people who are out of shape do Iron Woman or Iron Man triathlon, etc. But I do recommend moving. I recommend not being a lump. So we recommend exercises, rest, and recreation. Now, I happen to prefer resting more than anything else, but recreating is highly recommended, and so is exercising. Anyone know what this creature is? It's a meerkat. Yeah. And it's actually sunning itself in front of a heat lamp. So take advantage of the opportunities. Some years ago, we wrote an equation. This was about 1990 at Morris and I, an article called Medicine in Transition. And we argued that you could write an equation. The equation said there are good, helpful factors, and then there are unhelpful, bad factors. The helpful factors are nutrition, activity, and attitude. The unhelpful factors are the deficits, the lack of essential nutrients, toxins, and distress. That's been applied in a number of contexts, most recently by Amory Levins and Don Berwick at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, the keynote speech a year ago December. And so it's beginning to get some currency that we actually could do functional predictive sensitive tests, not the red and blue and dead tests that I grew up doing as a young pathologist. So loss of tolerance is a big issue. Healthy immune function is very important. You can restore the self-renewing capacities when the immune system is renewed, and that's what we do in our laboratory. That is, we do the cell cultures, and then we send back an interpreted report that recommends what changes in diet, what alkaline whey diet would be best for that individual, what targeted supplementation activities and attitudes would confirm a remission or would evoke a remission from their condition. We recommend using the healthy mucins, secretory IgA, probiotic bugs, mucosal permeability barriers, and dendritic first responders. These are the Thrive at 5 components. We recommend the mucins that are in your gut. You want a little bit, but not too much. That's what the visual is in the middle of the slide. Secretory IgA is this very unusual trapper of anything foreign, but it has a finite capacity. Probiotic, you want the good bugs to crowd out the bad bugs. Mucosal permeability factors like the dendritic first responder cells, the 50 billion first responder cells, each of which, when they're healthy, can eat up 50 bacteria, 50 viruses, 50 prions, 50 foreign things. 2.5 trillion foreign invaders can be neutralized by healthy people every minute of the day. So healthy people are really quite well protected. The problem is that most people are walking wounded and don't know it. So we recommend an alkaline balance through self-testing, first AM urine pH testing, little strip that changes color based on how acid or alkaline you are. We recommend checking your antioxidant need and taking enough ascorbate to meet that need. We recommend checking your stress response, either through galvanic skin response or skin temperature measurement. We recommend checking mucosal permeability through glutamine recycling. And we recommend activating those first responder cells with quercetin and OPC. These are polyphenolic natural molecules that activate the first responder cells. So we do recommend checking the first morning urine pH, keeping a healthy range of 6.5 to 7.5. We recommend checking the ascorbate because you might need 4 grams, but you might need 100,000 milligrams depending on your individual requirements. We recommend checking the core and peripheral temperature because your core temperature is actually quite constant, but your skin peripheral temperature can be quite variable. If your skin temperature is cold and your core temperature is healthy, then you're stressed. And when you're less stressed, your skin temperature will warm up. Then there's transit time. Turns out the healthy transit time from consumption to elimination is 12 to 18 hours. Average Americans have a 4-day transit time, and it's not unusual for people to be regular in the sense of having an evacuation every day, but what comes out today might be from last Tuesday. And then you get to reabsorb the spermines, cadaverines, and putrescines, and I don't know many people that prefer to have a high putrescine content in their body, and I certainly don't in mine. Now, this shows you about 3,500 people that we assessed in regard to how much ascorbate they need. On the far left of the slide, you see a yellow spike. Those are the healthy people that calibrate on less than 4 grams. Then you see a kind of blue area, which is calibrating between 5 and 10 grams. Then you see a very large kind of light blue turquoise area calibrating between 10 and 130 grams. And on the far right, people who calibrate over 130 grams. That's 130 grams, folks, not 130 milligrams. 130,000 milligrams in order to saturate their need and flush toxins out of their body. So some people need a lot because they're using it up so fast, and some people don't need much because they're conserving it a lot, and you can find out using the ascorbate calibration protocol. So in practice, we recommend identifying the immune, the toxin, the neurohormone burdens. We recommend substituting for the reactive foods, substituting for reactive medications with other medications. We recommend stimulating repair by evoking these healing responses.
We recommend restoring tolerance and achieving sustained remissions. We recommend personalized better outcomes by design. And this is what we call PERC Integrative Health. That integrates the principles and practices that I've been talking about. And there's a toll-free number if you want more information about that. It's 1-800-525-7372. And we're just waiting for your call to let you know any more information you might need to access these kinds of approaches. This is another moment of pause just to see if anyone has a question. This could be a digital visual effect, or it could be a hummingbird. Actually, we took this picture in Costa Rica. So there is what I call the Bonte effect. This is about health and being well. It's about health being a matter of balance. It's about health being sufficiency. It's about health being an inner state of ease. It's about this health equation of the health builders minus the health depleters. And this we put forward in a series of articles in the Journal of Management Development with the help of Hal Lazarus, who was the editor-in-chief of that series. And as Bonte said, the first 40 years of his life, he practiced the abusive life. And since then, he's been practicing the use of life. Which do you choose? This is the same fellow, the one who decoded the color healing system. He taught me about green dichromatic light, about forest and plant green meditation. He was the Sihanouk family's spiritual advisor. First time I saw him with King Norodom Sihanouk, Sihanouk bowed down and kissed his feet. I asked him why, and he said, well, he is permitted to do that. And I asked him if I should, and he said, why? Do you want to? He was Jawaharlal Nehru's doctor. Nehru died in his arms. I'd been a student for many years, and I heard that Nehru died in his arms, and I thought, I would have surely heard that story if it was true. So I went to him, and I said, did Nehru die in your arms? He says, well, you know, you must not say things that you cannot prove, Russell. And he reached into his pocket. Now, monks have a little vest that they wear, and there's a pocket. He pulls out two pictures. One is a picture of Nehru kissing his feet. Apparently people like to kiss his feet because he had stopped some kind of an event in the birth of India. He worked with Gandhi as well. And the other was a picture of Nehru laid out in state just before his body was burned, and Bonte was sitting in honor right next to the body. And he had other photos too of being Nehru's doctor. Now, I thought a Cambodian and a Buddhist couldn't possibly be the doctor of the Prime Minister of India, who's a Hindu. But what did I know? And he was the Dalai Lama's mentor. The first time I saw the Dalai Lama together with Bonte was on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. in 1983. And His Holiness made his remarks, came off the dais, sees Bonte, bows down and kisses his feet, goes off to the senators in proper protocol order to receive them. And he looked at me and said, I outrank him. It was also the basis for Yoda, if you know of the Yoda character in the Star Wars movies. Yoda sounds like, looks like, does things like what Bonte did. He lived either from 1887 or 1889, depending on you looking at his birth certificate or his passport. He lived until 1999, when due to a medical mistake, he passed away. Then they called me. Immune defense and repair systems can be your ally rather than your adversary. In Western medicine, they're generally seen as our adversary rather than our friend. I think we should reverse that. The mind-body, the integration of your mind and body. And by the way, did you know that no one's mind has ever been separated from their body? Did you know that no one's body has ever been separated from their mind? Not to the best of my knowledge. So that the mind-body amplifies perception. If you know it's going to be bad, it's likely to be worse. And if you know it's going to be good, it'll likely be better. You can recondition these responses. I can tell you from personal experience. You can recondition these responses. And I recommend practicing a relaxation response or active meditation, such as the Western tradition that Bob Lykman writes about, or any that you find companionable. There are many. When the students are ready, the teachers appear. There are no lack of teachers. When the students are ready, the teachers appear. So we can live in harmony with our nature. We can know our nature by practice. We can have honest communion from nature. That is being out in nature. And we can do outcome studies and rigorous science to confirm this for those who need statistics as well as confirmatory independent information. It's been a privilege to help contribute to that. There is a website for consumers. It's betterlabtestnow.com, all spelled out, BetterLabTestNow.com. And there you can get active and free hormone tests like salivary, cortisol, DHEA stress hormones, male and female hormones, adrenaline and serotonin neurohormones. Thyroid hormones can all be measured now in saliva, non-invasively, and accurately and meaningfully. And then there are the functional protocols that you do yourself, the ascorbate calibration, the first AMPH measurement, transit time, dehydration tests, and more, what we call the Alkaline Way. And I'll summarize synthesize all this with a first century comment from Hillel. This is from the Sayings of the Fathers. If we are not for ourselves, who will be for us? If we're only for ourselves, what are we? And if not now, if now is not the time to choose health, when is the time to choose health? So from skeptic to practitioner, it's been a privilege. It's been a privilege to share the few insights that I've gleaned over time with you. If you have any questions, I hope you will write them down and or pop them up, and we will get them in. Hi. Oh, good question. Food is the main thing that keeps you healthy. Food is the main thing that keeps you healthy, and can I name 5 or 10 foods that keep you healthy? I can tell you superfoods, but I can't tell you if you're reactive to those foods. Because let's say I tell you that berries and dark fruits are superfoods. They are. Let's say I tell you that ginger, garlic, brassica sprouts, eggs, and ginger, garlic, eggs, brassica sprouts, and onions are superfoods. They're detoxifying foods. But what if you have a food allergy to those foods? Then they wouldn't be right for you. So I can give you general answers to general questions. I can't give you specific answers to specific questions. The average person, would read a book. It's very short. It's just a few pages. It's called The Joy of Eating the Alkaline Way. And you know, if I could have said it in fewer words, I would have. But it's actually unfair to you if I say 5 or 10 things that in general might be generally kind of sort of true, but wouldn't be universally true, and I wouldn't really want to do that. He does. He does. And you know what? 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 I know Mehmet. I do. Because his teacher was a friend of mine. He was a neurosurgeon named Ayub Omaya. So I know Mehmet very well. And you know what he says? He reads a script. And you know who writes the script? Not him. His father-in-law. His father-in-law is a promoter. His father-in-law may be a medical doctor. I'm not aware of that. His father-in-law is a very good promoter. Yeah, very good promoter. So yes, if I chose to do national television the way he does, I would give global answers to every question. And you know, he's a very good guy, and I think he does give very good global answers, but I don't because I'm not that way. I really think people are individual, and it, in my view, actually creates an illusion to think that everybody needs brassica sprouts or everybody needs garlic, because I know that there are people who react against garlic, because I've seen them in our laboratory. So I can give you the same information, and I don't disagree with much of what he says. I think Mehmet Oz is a real good guy, and you should listen to him. Now, how similar is an Alkaline Way diet to vegetarian or vegan diet? The Alkaline Way diet will be a modified vegetarian diet. It's not a strict vegetarian diet. You can be an alkaline vegan, or you can be an unhealthy vegan. You can be an alkaline, healthy vegetarian, or you can be an unhealthy vegetarian. I do recommend that you be healthy, whatever else you are, and then I recommend that you make the choice of the diet that works for you. I know people who are strict vegans and sick. I know people who are omnivores and really healthy. In fact, there was even a study. And the study broke people into 3 groups. People who ate junk food got sick. That was not a surprise. Then there were the people who did their best under the circumstances, and they enjoyed what they ate, and they did very well. And then there were the people who were meticulous, and they tried to eat the perfect food, and they got sick. So you can stress yourself out over your diet. How does the Alkaline Way impact or help chronic health conditions? Well, not autoimmune diseases. Well, chronic health conditions to me would be cardiovascular disease. Chronic health conditions to me would be the degenerative diseases. Almost all chronic and degenerative diseases are autoimmune. Almost all autoimmune diseases are chronic and degenerative. They're just looking at three aspects of the same thing. So actually, I would say the same thing about chronic and degenerative diseases that I say about autoimmune diseases, and I would say the same things about autoimmune diseases that I say about chronic and degenerative ones. Are your slides available online? No, they're my slides. Thank you very much. Why does a person with cirrhosis caused by hemochromatosis, not alcoholic, and thank you for that clarification, why do they develop very low platelet levels, and then they gave the numbers? The platelets come from the bone marrow. The stimulus for the platelets come from the kidney. The stimulus from the kidney comes from the liver. So now you know there's a link actually between the liver, which when it gets scarred we call that cirrhosis, and the stimulus that is supposed to get the kidney to release the platelet stimulating factor that goes to the bone marrow and causes a big cell called a megakaryocyte to release the platelets. Now, what would I do? You didn't ask the question of what I would do, but I will give you the answer to what I would do. I would calibrate ascorbate. I think oxidative stress plays a role in that situation. I would take as much of the polyphenolics, the colorful foods. You can do it as vegetable juices or as things like orthopro-anthocyanidins and quercetin dihydrate. I would take a bunch of that to activate the repair dendritic cells and see if they could get in and reduce the cirrhosis so that the liver could send the signal to the kidney, so the kidneys could send the signal to the bone marrow and make more platelets. And we've seen that in a number of cases. Will you make your PowerPoint available through the Commonwealth Club? Yes, I'd be happy to. I really am happy to share the PDF of tonight, the slides from tonight, with anyone who is interested. If you could let maybe Bill know if you are interested, we'll get them to you by email. Or if you leave them on an email request and you trust that it will get out of my pocket, which I promise to try and do, we'll get it to you very promptly. So we're happy to share that with you. Any other questions?
What is the website for free testing of hormones?
Yeah, the website for free testing of hormones is betterlabtestsnow.com. betterlabtestsnow.com. And that is for consumer direct laboratory testing, hormones, and other aspects of health. I thought it was on one of the slides, which is why I'm flipping through this. You would think I would know the number of these slides. I thought it was there. Better lab tests now. It was there. Okay. One of the last ones. On the top in blue, right? I saw it. Thank you. Thank you for confirming that. Okay, any other questions? I thought there was one more hand. Yes, young lady.
Yeah, I thought I heard you say you can reset your immune system for tolerance.
Yes.
Does that then mean you can overcome allergies? Do I understand that?
Yes, I can. If you talk to 9 out of 16 doctors, they will tell you that once you're allergic, you're always allergic, and you come back every season, and you get either shots or pills, and you'll be a patient for life, and they'll get to know you really, really well. Right? Okay, so we're talking about the same thing. What I said is if you measure comprehensively through this new breakthrough test, a lymphocyte response assay, you can now find out what the real cause was, not just the symptoms. So if you treat the symptoms, you will stay allergic for life. If you follow this approach, you can get to the causes. When you comprehensively, when you simultaneously avoid the reactive foods and then reset with this alkaline way diet and a good attitude and good exercise and good supplements, you restore tolerance. Pause. Oh, you're good. Wow, you're fast.
I had something happen to me that might answer your question. I listen to Kevin all the time, too. And I didn't know I had allergies to food until Dr. Jaffe put me through a blood test. And I was eating turkey sandwiches all the time because turkey was good for me and Easter African. Along with a whole bunch of other things. So I became very convinced that no one can tell you what to
Thank you.
I didn't know you were allergic to it. What
symptoms? Well, you see, the symptoms, Jack, you see, I'd like, Jack, excuse me. Hi, I'm up front. The symptoms vary to the person. So we often get calls from people who have been told that dairy foods cause asthma, tomatoes cause arthritis. I could go on. It's not true. There is a statistical relationship, but I did tell you that I never take care of statistics, so I don't know what that statistical relationship means in regard to you as a person, Jack. But I can tell you that what you eat can eat you. I can tell you that if it's unusual, but it's applied, if it is applicable to you, it's very relevant because for you it's 100%. So, for example, I know people who say they react to wheat or gluten. It's in fashion right now to be reactive to gluten. About 50 times more people think they are than really are. It's actually very unusual. Celiac, SPRU, classic gluten intolerance is actually very unusual. Less than 1 in 200 people, much below that. But in some parts of certain zip codes, you would think that half the people are gluten intolerant. Now, we measure these people. We measure them in a laboratory, and we find that they don't react to gluten. But they react to sulfite, or they react to bromate, or they react to something that's an additive or an extender or a common excipient or a contaminant of bread, of wheat. So if you didn't do those unusual tests because they're uncommonly reactive, you would miss the detailed information that for that individual is really, really important. So that's why I do recommend, beyond the general points, and you can get them from Oprah, you can get them from Mehmet, you can get them from Dean Ornish, all of whom do very good work, and I would recommend you're listening to them. But remember that at the end of all of that, they have a disclaimer that says doesn't apply to individuals.
Our thanks to Russ Jaffe for his comments here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to this recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.